This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about reading that belongs to you. And this week we're handing over to Robert Kirkwood, who recorded the show live at this year's Boswell Book Festival that took place in Dumfries House in Ayrshire.
Thanks, Red. Yes, today's show is being recorded at the Boswell Book Festival in Dumfries House in Ayrshire, the world's only book festival dedicated to memoir and biography. Coming up, I'll be chatting to the co-founder and former editor of Private Eye, Richard Ingrams. Bomber pilot George Dunn tells me about his most important mission, and I'll be playing with fire with the charming actor Nigel Havers. But first, let's explore James Boswell himself and the festival he inspired with festival director Caroline Knox, editor of the Boswell Editions Gordon Turnbull, and all the way from the University of Otago in New Zealand, Paul Tankard. We'll also hear the voice of Jonathan Oliver reading from the epic Life of Samuel Johnson by James Boswell, which comes in at a cracking 67 and a half hours.
Boswell's advertisement to the first edition. I at last deliver to the world a work which I have long promised, and of which, I am afraid, too high expectations have been raised. The delay of its publication must be imputed, in a considerable degree, to the extraordinary zeal which has been shown by distinguished persons in all quarters to supply me with additional information concerning its illustrious subject, resembling in this the grateful tribes of ancient nations, of which every individual was eager to throw a stone upon the grave of a departed hero, and thus to share in the pious office of erecting an honourable monument to his memory.
James Boswell sprang from an ancient Ayrshire family which had been settled at Auchinleck since the 16th century. He was born in Edinburgh in 1740, where his father, who became Lord Auchinleck, was a judge in the Supreme Court of Scotland. His mother was descended from a minor branch of Scottish royalty. Now, from the start, Bozzy, as he was affectionately known, was drawn to the pleasure-loving side of life. His first visit to London at the age of 19 began a love affair with the city, which never wavered. But the ultimate prize for Boswell was his friendship with the towering figure of Dr. Samuel Johnson, compiler of the definitive dictionary of the English language and celebrated man of letters. Boswell's friendship led him to become Johnson's biographer, and the account of his life has never been out of print. His Life of Johnson established him as the inventor of modern biography and has upheld his reputation as one of the most innovative writers of the Enlightenment.
In reflecting that the illustrious subject of this work, by being more extensively and intimately known, however elevated before, has risen in the veneration and love of mankind, I feel a satisfaction beyond what fame can afford. We cannot indeed too much or too often admire his wonderful powers of mind, when we consider that the principal store of wit and wisdom which this work contains was not a particular selection from his general conversation, but was merely his occasional talk at such times as I had the good fortune to be in his company. And without doubt, if his discourse at other periods had been collected with the same attention, the whole tenor of what he uttered would have been found equally excellent.
More recently, Boswell's fame redoubled in the 20th century with the discovery and publication of his diaries, setting him alongside Pepys as one of the great diarists in the English language. Boswell ushered in the confessional memoir, which is so popular today. Nothing was omitted, including the innumerable sexual encounters, his battle with depression, his difficult relationship with his father, his frustrated political ambition, and his life as a lawyer in the Scottish courts. We'll find out more about the papers in a moment from George Turnbull and from Paul Tankard. But first, I asked festival director Caroline Knox how the Boswell Book Festival started.
It started because we have created a trust to promote the name of James Boswell, the great biographer who comes from Auchinleck in Ayrshire. And we realised quite early on that his work is no longer read. And we thought, how can we bring the attention back onto him? And as he was the founder of modern biography, the idea came that we should start a festival which was dedicated to telling people's life stories. So in other words, a festival of biography and memoir. We are the world's only festival of biography and memoir. And then the other thing we wanted to do was also bring a book festival into Ayrshire, because there's one in Glasgow and one in Wigton, but nothing in this part of the world. And we wanted to actually help the regeneration of this bit of the southwest. We moved from James Boswell's own home, Auchinleck House, because it sounds really mundane, because we'd run out of car parking spaces. We loved it there, and authors who love Boswell loved it there. But as we grew, we just did not have the space, and people were having to park in mud, and, you know, it just became too uncomfortable for people to want to come. So that's when we were very lucky to be welcomed here by Prince Charles and his team. And this has allowed us to expand, because we are using part of the estate as well. So our children's festival is down in the School of Engineering, and we have the Royal Drawing School here this year. So it's allowing us to expand and do different things.
Now, Boswell's book about Samuel Johnson is in the RNIB Talking Books Library, and the audio version comes in at 67 and a half hours.
Wow.
It's a bit of an epic work.
And I think that Boswell found in Johnson the father figure that he didn't have in his own father, with whom he was often in conflict. And, of course, Johnson was a great writer, more than just a great writer. And, of course, Boswell, that was what Boswell adored, and he loved mixing with people who were writers, artists. And so, in a way, the older man became the father figure that perhaps he might have chosen if he, you know, hadn't had his own father, Lord Auchinleck.
My vanity, or my kindness, makes me flatter myself that you would rather hear of me than of those whom I have mentioned. But of myself I have very little which I care to tell. Last winter I went down to my native town, where I found the streets much narrower and shorter than I thought I had left them, inhabited by a new race of people to whom I was very little known. My playfellows were grown old, and forced me to suspect that I was no longer young. My only remaining friend has changed his principles, and was become the tool of the predominant faction. My daughter-in-law, from whom I expected most, and whom I met with sincere benevolence, has lost the beauty and gaiety of youth, without having gained much of the wisdom of age.
Our theme allows us to program it, I think, in a more interesting way, because we are looking for people who have written... They're either great biographers, or we simply look at people who've written a book and who have an extraordinary life story to tell. I think it allows us a freedom. We don't have to go chasing the newest book all the time. We're chasing the most interesting life stories, and we try to get a real breadth, which is what... Because Boswell, in his own diaries, he's interested in everybody. And so we try to mimic this interest in everybody across our programme. And, I mean, it is indeed a challenge getting writers from London up here, because they have to give up a weekend to come to the festival.
I'm sure they don't mind.
But when they get here, of course, I think they love it, and they love the Ayrshire audience. The amount of writers who've said to me, our audience is particularly attentive and really warm and welcoming, I think they really appreciate that.
And a reply to Mr. Samuel Johnson from Norfolk Street, April the 23rd, 1755. Sir, the part of your dictionary which you have favoured me with the sight of has given me such an idea of the whole that I most sincerely congratulate the public upon the acquisition of a work long wanted and now executed with an industry, accuracy, and judgment equal to the importance of the subject. You might perhaps have chosen one in which your genius would have appeared to more advantage, but you could not have fixed upon any other in which your labours would have done such substantial service to the present age and to posterity.
Another clip there of Jonathan Oliver reading The Life of Johnson by James Boswell. Now, Dr. Gordon Turnbull is head of the Great Boswell Editorial Project at Yale University. I asked him if Boswell was somewhat of a forgotten figure.
Not exactly forgotten, that is, in the world of higher literary study, Boswell is a household name. He authored the great Life of Johnson and published it in the year 1791. That is a book which not only immortalized the great Dr. Johnson himself, who would have been immortal anyway through his own wonderful works, it also immortalized Boswell. It had the curious effect, however, of placing him in Johnson's shadow. That is, he became known for about the 150 years after his death as Johnson's biographer. Then in the 20th century came the remarkable recovery of his private papers, many of which had been stashed away at his ancestral home, Auchinleck House, a couple of miles from where we are now. Others had made their way across the Irish Sea to his descendants in Ireland called the Talbots of Malahide. Those papers were recovered after arduous and complicated effort, eventually sold to Yale University, which edits and publishes them. In the year 1950, there appeared the first volume of Boswell's private journal, the London Journal of 1762-63, and it rather astonished its academic editors by becoming a runaway worldwide bestseller. So Boswell has been known to literary history. But I would have to break that statement down into two parts. He became almost better known two centuries after his death than he was in his own immediate lifetime, and in some ways has been better known to literary history than he has been in the wonderful county of Ayrshire, the home of his ancestral estate, Auchinleck.
What sort of a job was that going through those papers?
In the original period, his descendants were fascinated by what they had, but were a little nervous about it. These days, in the 21st century, we take the idea of candid confessionality for granted. When I was confined at home by a ridiculous illness a few years ago, I inflicted upon myself 2 weeks of American daytime television and was shocked witless at what people admit to on national television. Boswell began to seem to me a paragon of reticence and self-concealment and pudicity. He's none of those things, but what it does show is how far ahead of the curve he was. His descendants in Scotland and then in Ireland didn't destroy the papers, although they did rip a few pages out, but they kept them, but were a bit understandably nervous about what we now know to be their very frank personal content. Boswell, well ahead of the post-Freudian era, the era of psychology and psychoanalysis and self-introspection, Boswell had a sense of writing as a therapy, as a way of assuaging the pain that we all will, as an inevitable feature of being alive, feel from time to time. And he knew the corollary of that, which was that people reading another person's account of distress and trying to battle through it would feel curiously and almost paradoxically comforted by that reading experience.
I think he was more important looking back than Johnson.
They were important in very different ways. Johnson will remain forever in the pantheon as a pioneering lexicographer. He was known for many years as Dictionary Johnson after his great and quirky but great Dictionary of the English Language came out in 1755. He was a brilliant moral essayist. His essays as The Rambler and The Idler stand up to reading now as burly, commonsensical, practical wisdom, lay sermons in a certain sense. His wry anti-novel, Rasselas, Prince of Abyssinia, will hold its own anywhere as a coming-of-age story, a quest for experience and knowledge that goes a bit funny at the end. It may even be that the young people know more than the elderly tutor Imlac actually does. They were different kinds of people. Boswell, now known as a pioneering figure in biography, but also a pioneering figure given his 20th century literary rebirth in the kind of candid confessional writing that Johnson himself would not have undertaken, being a very different personality.
Now, Johnson is famously, or perhaps as a joke, he's derisory to the Scots, and Boswell was a proper Ayrshireman. Did the two of them get on?
They got on famously. It's a complicated story, and I'm not even sure I, at this distance of time, can actually unravel how serious and how jokey Johnson was when he occasionally cracked his clever but sarcastic wit against the Scottish nation. We all know the famous dictionary definition of the word oats, a grain which in England is fed to horses, but which in Scotland supports the people. Boswell, who occasionally gave back as good as he got, was heard to remark, "Ah, sir, but what horses and what people?" To speak seriously for the moment, there were antagonisms between Scotland and England, even with the Union of the Crowns in 1603 and the Act of Union in 1707. English people like Johnson, who were alive at the time of the second Jacobite uprising, never really knew if there might be another one at some future point. There were political and doctrinal realities. Some of the witticisms, I do think, were just that, and a few of them were made playfully at his friend Boswell's expense. I'll say this about Boswell. He himself undertook the re-education of Dr. Johnson. Their famous tour to the Highlands and Hebrides in 1773 is one in which the older man was educated by the younger. Boswell tells us in his journal of a tour to the Hebrides that Johnson went home in great good humour, with his prejudices much lessened, and very grateful for the hospitality he'd been shown here, proving yet again that most things like national prejudices really are no more than a function of ignorance and occasionally arrogance.
Now, while Gordon Turnbull oversees Boswell's papers, Paul Tankard from the University of Otago in New Zealand has a different approach.
My collection is a collection of things that he did write for publication, but in ephemeral forms in newspapers and magazines. So he wrote 600 or so pieces for newspapers and magazines, and on the whole, they haven't seen the light of day since the 18th century. They get occasionally looked at by scholars who are wanting to fill in Boswell's biography, but no one's really looked at them in their own right as a body of material. And I was fascinated by the idea that there were these 600 things out there that had never been sifted through, gathered together. And so the challenge for me was to craft out of that a book that would represent Boswell as a journalist in all of his capacities. It could have been twice as long. There were other categories of material I could have included: his theatre reviews, his book reviews, and things about the law. He wrote about the law quite a bit, but instead I confined it to what I thought people would find most interesting: the life of Johnson, material about executions, actual reportage that he did, and a series of political, scurrilous political essays that he called The Rampager.
These were published anonymously, so did he keep copies of them, or did you have to go look for them following clues in his journal?
Last century, Frederick Pottle, who was in charge of the Boswell Editions office before Gordon Turnbull, he had done most of the bibliographical work on Boswell, and using Boswell's journals and also using Boswell's collections of clippings — Boswell kept everything, and as we heard before, the family kept everything as well — using those materials that only came to light in the early 20th century, it became possible to begin to identify the things that Boswell had written for newspapers.
We think fake news is something of today, but Boswell was quite a practitioner of fake news in his day.
In a sense, in the 18th century, most of the news was fake, or at least news that was true was the exception. Or we could put it another way and say that the things that were in newspapers, nobody expected them to be true. Some of them were, some of them weren't. What the newspapers recorded were things simply that were in circulation. And I don't think anybody had a real expectation that if you read it in the newspaper, it was necessarily true. It might have been, or it might not have been, and it didn't sort of matter a lot. I suppose if they were reporting the shipping news and court movements, things like that, they would have been accurate. But when it came to reporting other things like, you know, a certain literary gentleman was seen dining at the home of a certain Hibernian cleric visiting London, then people weren't identified. People who are in the know might have known what was being referred to. It might have been true, it might not have been. There are all sorts of other reasons for things being in the newspaper. And it was a completely different way of conceiving the newspaper, and it was more like the blogosphere of today. It was things that people wanted other people to think true or false.
Not much has changed.
Well, I think that, in fact, in the 20th century, when a lot of papers wanted to identify themselves as journals of record that could be relied upon to represent what had gone on a day-to-day basis, that's a bit of an anomaly, really, and that it's a sort of a 20th century invention. And in the 18th century, I think that newspaper readers would have read far more critically and cynically than we do, thinking to themselves, well, I wonder why this is in the newspaper, and I wonder who's contributed to it. And that was part of the story. Who might have put it in? Who might have contributed it? What might their interest have been? And then to assess whether it might have been true and might have been false.
And Boswell used the newspapers to his own ends.
Oh, yes, yes. If he had a cause that he was involved in, he wouldn't hesitate to publicise it through the papers. At the end of his career, when he devoted himself mostly to writing the life of Samuel Johnson, for the 9 years that he was writing it, he would feed the newspapers things about Johnson and about himself and about the life of Johnson, about other biographers of Johnson, all of which he hoped would keep up interest. And none of these things would have his own name on them, or some of them. The occasional one would when he wanted to make an official pronouncement, but most of the time they wouldn't have his name on them. They were just little things that were intended to keep people thinking, oh, Samuel Johnson is still important, is still an issue, and Mr. Boswell is still working on his biography, and that's all interesting and exciting. And if he, a couple of times he was involved in legal cases that he wanted to sway public opinion, or at least he wanted people to be interested in the case, and he would again feed things to the newspapers about what was going on in the case, and not under his own name, of course, because that would have undermined it. So it was a way of affecting the climate of opinion and keeping something current.
Fascinating stuff. And if you fancy listening for 67 and a half hours, The Life of Samuel Johnson by James Boswell is available as TB5715. You're listening to a Read On Air special recorded at the Boswell Book Festival, and we'll be back with Nigel Havers and Private Eye co-founder Richard Ingrams later in the show. And we'll have some real-life war heroes after this.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss, and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
This is an RNIB talking book.
I love talking books. I don't know what my life would be without them. I love travel books. I love all the people that travel the world and tell us what they've done. It's the one freedom I really have, is to read the books that I love and people doing things in the world. You just get absolutely drawn into the story. And it's difficult to get to your bed sometimes. I think talking books is the best thing ever.
Talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Military history is always popular at the Boswell Book Festival, and last year Robert spoke to Victor Gregg about his book Rifleman.
So Victor, how did you end up in Dresden under a death sentence?
I was in at the start in North Africa. We was in Palestine when war was declared. And we went right the way through that. And then at the end of the Middle East campaign at Cape Bon, they was going to send the battalion back to Palestine. And I didn't want to go back. And at that time, they was asking for volunteers for this new parachute battalion. So I volunteered for that. Anyway, we went into Italy via Taranto. And then I landed up at Arnhem. I was captured at Arnhem and got eventually into this work camp, which was on the outskirts of Dresden.
But you escaped three times.
On the third time I tried to escape, they kept recapturing me. And the chap in charge of the camp, he was an old German naval officer, he decided, he said, I've got to punish you. He said, I admire your persistence, he said, but I've got to punish you, so you've got to go and work in a soap factory. Well, nobody wanted to work in his soap factory because it was 6 kilometres away. And this was February. And the snow was about 2 feet deep. And you had to walk it all there and all wet all the way back. See? So on the second day, he said, I'll come up with something for you, Victor, he says. You can have these wooden clogs. He gave me these wooden clogs, about an inch and a half thick wooden soles on them. He says, they'll keep your feet dry walking through the snow. When I got there, I was put in charge of shoveling this stuff, this sort of soap powder, into this big vat. And there was a big Yorkshire bloke who was already there. So the two of us were working together. So on the other side of this big workplace, there were some Italian prisoners building a wall. And they had a big pile of cement piled against it, and it was the same colour as this soap powder. So we decided to fill the wheelbarrow with cement and see what happened. And, of course, what happened was that when the German supervisor, it was all done by touch, when he thought, well, you know, take it out of the mixer, put it in the trays, then in the oven, see, make the tablets. But it was too watery. He couldn't make it out why it was too watery. So if you're going to leave it overnight and then start again in the morning. And in the morning, of course, they come down, he pulls the lever down to start all the machinery. Of course, nothing moved, did it? Everything was solid. So the wiring all caught alight, and it was a very old building. So all the roof went up, and they quickly sussed the two of us out and sent for the local police. They come up, and as we drove away, the old building collapsed inwards. So we had to go into Dresden, go in front of this bloke, this German officer, and he said, I can't do nothing about it. He says, sabotage. He says, you'll be shot tomorrow. That's it, see? Take them away. So they took us away to this place, right in the centre, bullseye, right in the centre of Dresden, right in the centre of Centerstadt. And there was about 300 or 400 people in there. It was crammed tight. It was terrible, it was. And that night they came over and bombed it. This big blaster bomb come and landed outside the building and pushed it all in. And I got away with it. It picked me up and threw me over the other side of the building, and I was covered up in masonry and stuff like that. But I was one of the 30 or 40 who escaped annihilation on that night, and so that's why I didn't get executed. So that's the answer to that question. I'll wait with trepidation for the next one.
Right, OK, just one. What's kept you going?
What's kept me going? I ain't got a clue. I just haven't got a clue how I'm still alive. Probably it's a mental attitude, half of it. I never worry about things. Life has taught me that if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And you get in a situation, you cannot do anything about it. You've got to overcome the situation the best way you can. So don't worry. Carry on. So there's various things. I don't know. I don't feel any sign even now of impending disaster or termination. I just realise if I'm walking downstairs, I've got to walk down very, very carefully because I'm liable to trip up. So, yeah, I suppose it's like everything else. Why have I survived? How have I survived when all my mates, all my friends, they've all kicked it, they're all dead, and I'm still here? It's just a matter of luck, I think. And I'm grateful for it.
I left Waterloo and walked, weighed down by all my worldly belongings, all the normal army kit. I lugged it through all the familiar places, across Waterloo Bridge, up the Old Witch, along Kingsway and on to Russell Square, my old stamping grounds. My impatience to get home finally got the better of me, and I took a tube to the Caledonian Road. In no time, I was outside the two small rooms on the second floor of our tenement house in Ellington Street. By now I was a bag of nerves, but the love I was greeted with is something I shall never experience again.
Rifleman by Victor Gregg and by Rick Stroud is available from RNIB Talking Books now.
Robert Kirkwood talking to Victor Gregg. And this year was no exception, as the festival was attended by two aircrew survivors who helped Britain triumph in World War II. Here's bomber pilot George Dunn telling Robert about his memories of joining up.
We were all young. We were, I suppose, a lot different to an 18, 20-year-old of today. There was no such things as tablets or smartphones or anything like that. So we were quite happy to, well, I was anyway, to have the opportunity of joining up, because when you think about it, at the end of the day, I was able to fly two of the finest aircraft in the Air Force, which was the Mosquito and the Spitfire, and got paid for doing it.
How long did the training take?
Well, I started flying in January 42 in Canada, finished in September. That was EFTS and service flying training. That was two courses. Came back to this country in September 42. Got back to this country, did a short course on Airspeed Oxfords to get used to English conditions, because, of course, we had blackout here, whereas Canada was all lit up. From there, on to OTU on Wellington's. From OTU on Wellington's down to New York on Halifax's, and then onto a squadron. So if you say from January 42 to April 43, that will be the time factor. So that's, what, 15 months? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Doesn't sound very long.
You couldn't avoid the time gap, really, because don't forget, you had to travel to Canada, you had to come back, and then there was a period of in a hotel at Bournemouth before going on the first course. So there's a certain amount of that time which was, you might call, dead time.
What missions really stand out to you? What ones do you really remember?
Well, of course, the main one was Peenemünde. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Peenemünde was the where the V weapons were produced. And when it was first notified to the intelligence services in 1940, but they didn't take any notice. They thought it was a ruse to divert the intelligence services for no good reason. So as the years went on, this was 1940, and don't forget the first V1 V2 rocket was not fired until September 44, because they had a lot of setbacks with the production of the V weapons, particularly the Doodlebug, which was a forerunner of the V weapon. But had that not taken place, the Peenemünde raid, we might well have been in trouble in this country, because at that time they were producing what they called the V3, which was a huge gun, which would have fired, if it had been produced, would have fired 60 rockets a minute on London. And you can imagine the... So Peenemünde, without doubt, was the most important raid that I took part in.
Was it heavily defended?
No, it wasn't.
Quite unusual.
You see, it was too near Berlin. And they didn't... You see, there had been lots of reconnaissance flights over Peenemünde, but they never fired on the aircraft because they didn't want the authorities to know that there was anything going on. If they'd fired on the reconnaissance aircraft, it would have given the game away.
When was the last time you flew?
When I came out the RAF in 1947. I brought a Halifax back from Egypt and delivered it to Fairford in Gloucester, and that was it.
Right. Never had the desire to get back in the cockpit?
I did win in a raffle a half an hour's instructional flight on a Goodwood. when he let me take over.
Thanks to Robert and George, there are many books on military history in the Talking Books Library, including the aforementioned Rifleman, which is TB number 21920. The legendary Richard Ingrams was also in attendance at the Boswell Book Festival, talking about his life and his new book, Ludo and the Power of the Book. He's possibly most remembered for co-founding and editing Private Eye, which is available from RNIB newsagent, and sometimes it's read by a very familiar voice.
Dumb Britain. Pointless. BBC One. Alexander Armstrong. Name a country south of the UK on the same longitude. Contestant, Paraguay. For What It's Worth, BBC One. Firm Britain. Sri Lanka is located off the southeast coast of which Asian country? Contestant, Africa. Tipping Point, ITV. Ben Shepherd. Of which African country is Kampala the capital? Contestant, Nepal. The National Lottery, five-star family reunion, BBC One. Nick Knowles, Jeremy Corbyn is the leader of which political party? Contestant, the Conservatives.
Robert asked Richard Ingrams about his new book.
Ludo and the Power of the Book is my book, and it's not a biography of Ludovic Kennedy. It's been described as that, but it's not really a biography. It really consists of four quite different murder stories in which Ludo was involved, not discovering the guilty man, but in proving that the guilty man was in fact innocent in each case. He was originally got involved in the cause of miscarriage of justice when he was asked to review a book about the Rillington Place, the famous Rillington Place case involving Timothy Evans, who had been convicted of murdering his wife and his baby, when in fact, as emerged later on, they had been murdered along with several other women by a man living in the same house, John Christie. Evans was hanged for murder, although he was quite innocent, as later became clear. And Ludo wrote a book about that called Ten Rillington Place, which became a famous book and was very instrumental in bringing about the repeal of capital punishment in England, which eventually took place, I think, in 1965. But after that, having written that book, he became the target for lots of people who thought that they'd been wrongly convicted. And my book is about the Rillington Place story, but also three other cases. One, the case of Paddy Meehan, the Glasgow criminal. The Luton Post Office murder of 1975, which is a famous case. And finally, the kidnapping of the baby boy and murder of baby boy of Charles Lindbergh, the famous American pilot, first man to fly across the Atlantic, single-handed.
That seems a very serious book for someone who used to edit Private Eye.
Well, I hope it's not too serious. There's a lot of good jokes in it. Ludo himself was a very lively, humorous character who was particularly good at saying rude things about judges, which is partly why he appealed to me, because I've had a certain experience of that.
Now, tell us about the founding of Private Eye.
Well, Private Eye sprung up really as a result of a group of people who, myself included, who were friends from school and university. And we started in 1961 with no money at all. And by lucky chance, really, it took off. And that was partly due to the fact that of the political situation at that time, where the Tories had been in power for a long period, and there was a move, a discontent, which took its form of political satire, which notably flourished in the famous TV programme, that was the week that was. That came along after privatised started. But thanks to that particular situation at that time, Private Eye took off. And it was brought up after about six issues by Peter Cook, who remained the owner of Private Eye until he died. And that was a very fortuitous thing that happened, because he was obviously a very funny man and was helped in that way. But he was also, as proprietor, he never interfered at all in the running of the magazine, so that the editor, which was myself, had complete freedom to do whatever he liked. And that situation has remained the case even after Peter's death. The editor, Ian Hislop, has been free to do whatever he likes. And that's a very unusual situation.
We've had the writing of Alan Corran on the show before. Now, Alan Corran was editor of Punch while you were editor of Private Eye. Was there a rivalry?
Well, we were sort of rivals. We used to appear on the BBC's news quiz every week, or whenever it was on, anyway. I think Private Eye did have a feeling about Punch from the very early days, that we were going to, Willie Rushton used to say, we're going to knock Punch off his perch. And there was a certain attitude about that towards Punch, and to Alan in particular, I suppose.
Now, one thing I've always wondered about Private Eye, see those wee adverts in the back where it's please help and a bank account number and a sort code, do they ever work?
Well, I'm told that they do. otherwise, they wouldn't appear. It seems amazing, but there it is.
Now, you've moved on to the oldie.
Yeah, that again was started almost as an accident by a group of friends, including myself. We managed to get a backer for it in the shape of Naima Tullett. And again, like Private Eye, it had a tricky start. Because we didn't have the amount of capital you really need to start a new paper. But again, thanks to a series of strokes of good fortune, it survived. And it's still coming out today after 25 years.
Thanks to Robert and to Richard Ingrams. And coming up in a moment, we'll be playing with fire with Nigel Havers. As I said, Private Eye is available from RNIB Newsagent, and we'll tell you how you can get it after this.
Nursery Times. Kiss the Girls and Bake Them Crygate. New Revelations. By our political correspondent, Georgie Porgy Washington. The boy at the centre of allegations of sexual harassment and inappropriate behaviour, Trumpy Pumpy Pudding and Pie, has refused to apologise for his conduct in the playground. These girls made up the whole thing, all nine of them. I never kissed anyone without their consent, so I don't have to apologise for anything. However, a number of boys came out to play a secret recording in which Trumpy Pumpy boasted that he could kiss any girl he liked because he was a famous nursery rhyme character and they wouldn't dare cry. Mr. Trump then ran away, shouting, "That is just guy stuff, it's locker room banter, and if you want to talk about caveman behaviour, just look at what Bill Clintstone got up to, whilst his wife, Hilma, turned a blind eye. That's what I call being in deep yabba-dabba-doo." Nursery Land supporters of Trumpy Pumpy were shocked by these revelations about his behaviour. Said Little Boy Blue Collar and Robin Redneck, "The guy's a wimp. Why did he just kiss them? Why didn't he grab them by the puss in boots?"
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Reading is essential to feeling included and independent, but when experiencing sight loss, gaining access to the same magazines and newspapers as your peers can be a challenge. RNIB Newsagent can remove those barriers. Whether you're interested in the daily papers, Reader's Digest or BBC Good Food, our service can deliver a wide range of popular titles in formats to suit you. Prices start from just £25 a year, and if you pay by direct debit, we'll give you a 20% discount. To find out more and request a copy of our new catalogue or sample magazine, please call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Allison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On, recorded at the Boswell Book Festival. Now, the Curtain Up event at this year's festival featured an evening with Nigel Havers, who was there to talk about his autobiography, Playing With Fire. The unabridged RNIB Talking Book version is read by Charles Armstrong.
By the time we came to shoot what would be the opening scene in Chariots of Fire, I had been inhabiting the skin of Lord Alfred Lindsay for several months. So, when Hugh Hudson, the director, asked if I felt able to age up in order to play my character as a man well into his 80s, I had little hesitation. The scene was a memorial service for the sprinter Harold Abrahams and took place in a London church. I had to spend 6 hours in makeup. As the face in the mirror got steadily older, I started remembering my grandfather, the way he walked, the way he talked and held his head. And as the finishing touches were at last applied, I suddenly remembered that Dad's chambers were just round the corner, so rang and invited him to come to the set and watch some of the morning's filming. When he arrived, he walked straight past me and professed not to recognise me at all until he heard my voice. I'm not sure if his reaction was genuine or whether he was doing it to give me pleasure. Either way, it was rather charming. My father was quite a guy. He had two passions, the law and living, the first providing the second. Law runs through the Havers family like blood runs through veins. My grandfather was Sir Cecil Havers, a notable High Court judge who was famous for, among other things, sentencing Ruth Ellis, the last woman to be executed in this country. My aunt is Dame Elizabeth Butler Sloss, also a High Court judge, and until recently head of the family justice system. My brother Philip is an eminent human rights barrister, and my niece Holly has recently joined one of London's largest firms of solicitors. Then there's me. Actually, I think every successful barrister has to have something of the actor in him, and Dad didn't just have a little something, he had it in spades. In 1981, as Attorney General, he was obliged to be chief prosecutor in the trial of Peter Sutcliffe, the notorious Yorkshire Ripper. On the day Dad started his case for the prosecution, I slipped into the viewing gallery. He had rung the week before to ask whether I wanted to come and see something special. "Is that the new play at the National?" I asked. No, he replied. I thought you might like to come and see me for a change. Peter Sutcliffe was surprisingly small, with wild, black, curly hair and very black eyes. The sort of eyes that have swallowed up the horror they have witnessed, and sacrificed all life and expression in the process, leaving dark holes the colour of deadly nightshade in their place. When the judge gestured for proceedings to begin, my father got slowly to his feet. He stood, motionless, looking down at his notes. Silence. He stayed like that for several minutes, the tension building to breaking point. Just as the judge was about to intervene, he looked up, straight into Sutcliffe's eyes. Another silence. "Could you confirm how you spell your name?" he said. "One T and two Fs. Is that right?" Sutcliffe just nodded. Dad turned. There was a flurry of activity from the junior counsel huddled behind him. Everyone in the courtroom seemed to be holding their breath. Another long silence. I think the judge thought Dad had lost the plot. Eventually, Dad turned and fixed Sutcliffe with a hawk-like stare. "At least we've got that right," he said. "Tell me, did you enjoy killing those women?" The air suddenly seemed to have been sucked out of the room. It became difficult to breathe, and people started to lick their lips. I looked down and saw goosebumps on my arms. It felt as if the air conditioning had suddenly been cranked up to maximum.
So begins Playing with Fire by Nigel Havers. At the Boswell Book Festival, he told me about the book.
Well, the book is about me. You know, I spent 3 months writing this book. 9 to 5, like I was sort of going to an office, I did it, and I was sort of rather dreading doing it to begin with, but I really enjoyed doing it in the end. And I didn't have too much interference, and there you are. It was a fun experience.
And you read the abridged version?
I loved that. I've done sort of radio and commercial voiceovers for years, so I love just talking into a microphone. I find that kind of rather restful.
Life was hell. The lack of food and sleep were beginning to turn me stark, staring bonkers, added to which, looking back, I think I truly began to believe that I was William Wills. For the one and only time in my life, a part began to inhabit my being, and I started behaving very oddly. One day, as I was putting on my filthy old costume and having the makeup done, I noticed that the shot required us to be practically crawling on the ground. It was to be filmed by a sodding great long lens, and Graham and the crew were sitting miles away, waiting for us to get into position. "I'm not going anywhere until that director comes over to say good morning," I said. Shock registered on the face of the third assistant, this normally mild-mannered and quite cheerful actor throwing a hissy fit, or spitting the dummy, as they call it over there. He quickly walked over to Graham. "Nigel says he's not doing anything until you come and say good morning." Pause. "Has he lost his mind?" Well, I think he means it. I screwed up my eyes and watched Graham, dressed in his habitual white linen, walk the 100 yards or so to where I was standing. "Good morning," he said, and he turned on his heel and walked back. The outback can do strange things to a person. One scene took place in a dust storm, and we had to have aeroplane propellers chucking dust in our faces for 3 whole days, unimaginably foul for us. Piece of cake for Simon and the rest of the camels. Those guys can survive anything. We also had to contend with the flies. I know everyone talks about those Aussie flies, but until you experience them at first hand, you can have no idea how hellish they make your life. I wore a hat with a net whenever I wasn't actually on camera, but on one close-up a fly actually walked across my eye, right across the middle. I'm quite proud of the fact that I didn't flinch, but the secret fact is that because I wear contact lenses, I was just about able to bear it. Another time we were filming on some salt flats. You could see at least 100 miles in every direction, everything dancing in that torrid heat. The crew were about 0.5 mile away, filming with the longest lens in existence. There is only one of those lenses in the entire world because it is so expensive to produce. Directors have to put themselves on a list and queue to use it, all of which adds to the pressures of filming, as there is absolutely no margin for error. Jack and I were acting up a storm, half-crazed with thirst and exhaustion. One of us glanced over at the crew and found that they had broken for lunch and forgotten to send the runner to tell us. "I'll kill them," I yelled. Jack was able to find this quite amusing, but madman that I had become, I sulked for days.
Now, one chapter of the book stands out, your filming experience in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was because the character I played in that movie, Birkenwood, was such an extreme, you know, to die in the middle of nowhere, and it got under my skin a bit. But it was a good experience and an amazing story.
Especially when you got back to civilization and you couldn't leave the hotel room.
I couldn't, no. We lived, you know, 800 miles from the nearest telephone or town. And after two months or so, you forget about things like traffic and noise and stuff. So when I came back to the big city, I got sort of agoraphobia. I couldn't leave. I couldn't leave the room. I couldn't cross the road. I tried to, but I just went straight back.
We eventually arrived in Adelaide, where we had a few days off before some more shooting just outside the city. It was terrifying. Suddenly, I found myself on my own in the middle of an enormous city, and I couldn't deal with the culture shock. By the time I got to my hotel room, I was a bundle of nerves, and I didn't leave the room for 2 days. I rang home to speak to Caro and give my love to Kate before I passed out. I just slept, ate room service food, and generally got my head together. The rest of the cast were doing exactly the same thing. We were all completely drained and exhausted.
Is it important that there's an accessible version of your book?
I actually have a sight problem myself, in fact. The retinal membrane at the back of my right eye is becoming unattached, so I have problems with my right eye, so I can, you know, understand how difficult it is to be blind, and I'm very aware of, you know, doing as much as I can to help.
Is that something that you're aware of on stage, like you have to be extra careful where your mark is and things like that?
I do now, yeah. I have to work much harder. It's putting a key into a keyhole is more difficult.
I realised I was grinning like an idiot. There was a light at the end of the tunnel. I knew things were never going to be easy, but there was just a chance that, together, we could get life back on track. With post-production schedules in Sydney, we weren't due back in London for a couple of months. Whatever the future held, I'd be able to take a break from playing with fire.
Nigel Havers, thanks so much for joining me on RNIB Connect Radio.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for asking.
Thanks, Robert. Nigel Havers' book, Playing with Fire, is available as TB19820. Thanks to Robert and to everyone who took the time out to talk to him at the Boswell Book Festival. Next week, we'll be talking to some of the narrators who turned the written words that so many of us struggle to read into the talking books that we all love. In the meantime, if you've got any suggestions for titles that you think we should feature in future shows, we're just an email away. readonair@rnib.org.uk. Until then, thanks for listening, and don't forget to read on.